Welcome to the Sinica Podcast, a weekly discussion of current affairs in China, coming to you from the pop-up Chinese studios here in Beijing. I'm Kaiser Guo, and with me as usual is Jeremy Goldcorn, the man behind Danway.com. How are you, sir?
Good evening, Kaiser.
We've got a great show for you this week, in no small part because we've got two of Beijing's very finest journalists joining us. Gadi Epstein is, of course, a correspondent for The Economist. Say hello, Gadi.
Hello, Kaiser.
And welcome back to Sinica.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be back.
Also with us today is Ed Wong of The New York Times. Great to have you back, man.
Thanks a lot, Kaiser.
All right. So before I go on, let me remind everyone that you can follow us on your Facebook page at facebook.com/SinicaPodcast or on Twitter at SinicaPodcast. So guys, the number of potential topics for the week was almost overwhelming. It was overwhelming. So let's just flick at a couple of items and then dig deeper in weeks to come on some of these things. I'm sure they're all developing. And for today, let's keep our focus on a couple of the bigger stories. And there was none bigger than, the astonishing story of Chen Guangcheng and how the plight of that activist precipitated a Sino-American diplomatic crisis that in many ways overshadowed the whole strategic and economic dialogue in Beijing last week. We will get to that amazing and as yet still unfolding story very soon. But first, while we've got Ed here, I want to talk very briefly about what some are calling Ferrarigate.
I think that would be you and maybe Bill Bishop.
Okay, me and Bill Bishop.
You and Bill Bishop. Maybe two people in Beijing. Oh, that's
good. Right. I said some. I mean, two is some. Okay, so anyway, what prompted you to pursue the accuracy of that anecdote that we've all heard? The Wall Street Journal led that now infamous piece about Bo Guagua pulling up the ambassador's residence in a red Ferrari, attired in a tuxedo. What made you go after that?
Well, we weren't going after it because of the anecdote itself. It was more the idea that we learned through talking to various people, some conversations done inadvertently, that it seems that Ambassador Huntsman was the one who really started the rumor mill on this story that turns out to be false. And I thought that it was an interesting insight into sort of how
he's a big fat liar.
No. Right. Well, are you Democrat?
I like Huntsman a lot.
Insight. Yeah, he's got a lot of fans. But I thought it gave good insight into sort of how the rumor mill works in Beijing, especially in expat circles, and then how that eventually becomes this trope that gets repeated and actually becomes a significant political item that, Bo Xilai, one of China's most powerful leaders, had to address at the National People's Congress.
Right. And so how was the reporting done on this? What did you actually do?
It's sort of obvious how it started. It started with Bo Guagua's statement in the Harvard Crimson saying he had never driven a Ferrari and that he had never shown up at the ambassador's residence. Now, I don't know how much of that, those like more wide-ranging statements are true, but then we contacted the Huntsman daughters, and they said that at the very least, that night, he didn't show up at the residence, that they were picked up and brought over to him at a group dinner. And so it obviously wasn't a date. It wasn't a one-on-one date. Right. He wasn't wearing a tuxedo, as far as we can tell. And maybe
he was wearing one of those T-shirts with a tuxedo painted on it.
Right. Could have been one of those.
Silk-screened
one. It's unclear what kind of car he drove later that night. I mean, he says he showed up in a black Audi at the dinner. One of his friends says the same thing. And then there's a vague recollection that there might have been a red sports car at some other point in the evening, but no one really can tell. So
they'd all gotten totally faced, right?
Mm-hmm. Right, right. Mm-hmm. Well, we heard there was hard partying that night. But and then there's even disagreement on which bar they went to later on that night.
Like, who's the party can remember after?
Basically, they all got drunk and nobody can actually remember if there was a red Ferrari.
Right. One person told me there's no, it must not have been a memorable night for anyone involved.
Right.
Don't you think this is indicative of a certain sloppiness in all of the reporting on Bo Xilai in the Western media, though?
Or all Western media reporting in general.
Generally.
Yeah, are we talking about the Times editors here?
No, I don't want to talk about any particular publication, but there are two things I know about the Bo Xilai affair that I know independently of any media because of people I knew in the 90s in Beijing. The one thing is that Neil Hayward's wife's name is not Wang Lulu, but Wang Lu. And she goes by the English name, Lulu Wang. And the other thing that I know is that it wasn't Neil Hayward who did the fixing for Bo Guagua to get into Harrow. Those are the only two things I know about this case. and the evil Western media has not got them right. And it makes me think that there must be many, many details that have gone missing. And I can't understand why some things aren't being pursued, like the Daily Mail, and not a particularly reputable British newspaper's story about Neil Haywood pinching Gukailai's bottom in the seaside resort town in England. Why didn't anybody follow that up and go back? You know, the only word we have from that hotel is the Daily Mail.
Forensic evidence of a butt pinch.
I think the Times also had a piece that was sort of tied into that same sort of
But did they send a reporter to ask the hotel? I mean, what I
Not
find frustrating
Times,
is the Borsilai story, for the first time, there's a Chinese political story that there's a lot of information outside of China that is one could get at with the resources of a CNN or a New York Times or an Economist.
Well, I would say that, I mean, not to, you know, flatter our fellow guest here, but I think the New York Times actually has done some of the best reporting on this. They've done a couple of terrific stories that sort of outline what we do know about the investigation here domestically and what in China and what prompted perhaps Bo Xilai's troubles to begin with. So that includes the wiretapping story that they did that was fantastic.
That was fantastic. That was a
And I think they've done very good and I would say very careful reporting on this. Maybe they've gone – I don't know if every single detail has been absolutely nailed down, but I think they've done – they've been very careful.
Right. And to give the journal credit, like even though we talked earlier about their Ferrari anecdote, I mean they were the ones who –
Ferrari Gate, you're referring
right,
to.
Ferrari Gate, as our host likes to call it. But they were the ones who made the biggest break in the story, which was the
– Neil Haywood
tying the murder of Neil Haywood and the investigation into that to – to the investigation into Bo Xilai.
Wasn't that Bo Xun that actually made that connection originally?
A lot of rumors were in Bo Xun. And the journal,
the journal confirmed it,
did great reporting on it. The New York Times confirmed a lot of rumors that were out there as well.
Right, the wiretapping started off as a rumor. I mean, right. There are lots of rumors, and some of them are half true.
Most of the scurrilous reporting you're talking about starts out in the overseas Chinese press.
Right. Hey, listen, though, who's going to doubt John Huntsman if he's your source on an anecdote like that? I mean, is it really their fault?
Well, that's part of – I mean, that goes into a deeper question about reporting in general and also reporting China, because part of the hazards of reporting in China is you're often relying on sources who are at least one step removed from the principal event and oftentimes several steps removed. Every time you write a story that's usually involves politics – in this case, it's not that political a story, but it's more of a gossip story. But it does involve politicians, and so it's hard to get at the heart of the matter. You're rolling the dice, you're taking gambling, you're hoping that it'll be true because you're hoping that your sources are reliable. Right. You haven't spoken to any – I mean, at least in the first iteration of the story, my guess is that no one spoke to any of the principals involved.
The daughters.
Involved, right, because they
– you spoke to the daughters.
We spoke to the daughters as well as – Guagua, as well as three people at the dinner. So I feel our story is probably the first one where we spoke to the people who were directly involved in the event.
Okay. Well, let's leave Ferrari Gate. I mean, that's we've done this one justice.
Well, whenever you like, Kaiser.
Yeah, I get to call it here. Let's sort of move on to another big story that's still developing. The showdown on disputed Huangyan Island or Scarborough Shoal. Has anyone written, like, are you going to Scarborough Shoal? Oh, sailing to Scarborough
Shoal. Are you going to be doing a little bit of karaoke here?
Yeah. Okay, anyway, so this South China Sea island that, of course, lies not terribly far off the coast of one of the main Philippine islands. Anyway, this showdown, can one of you quickly take us through the events there from mid-April when Chinese fishing boats were spotted all the way through, you know, what's going on right now?
I think Jeremy. I saw you wrote a blog post about this today. I think Jeremy's the right.
Jeremy, it's false to you.
I wrote a blog post about the reaction to it. I don't think I'm the right person. Basically, if we can compress it into 30 seconds, China claims a piece of the South China Sea that extends like a tongue down from the southern Chinese coast, very close.
Like a bovine tongue, basically.
A bovine tongue next to Philippines, Malaysia, Brunei, and everybody else in Southeast Asia. And they claim a lot of little pieces of rock that stick out as old historical Chinese territory, and they're very firm about this. And there have been... what was the thing that set off the current one?
The Philippines is part of China, historically. That was a good one.
We'll get to that.
What happens in these areas is disputes between fishing boats and coast guards. And one of these disputes has now escalated into a major diplomatic incident. So China, the Chinese state press and people on Weibo are going nuts because they're saying that Philippines is disrespecting them by not completely bowing down in front of their sovereignty statements.
So the Chinese leadership has been clearly kind of fanning or at least allowing to burn uncontrolled these sort of nationalist flames. Are we seeing the kind of wag the dog thing going on? I mean, a lot of people suggest that this is all about distracting from other maybe more pressing issues.
That was my blog post. I don't think that's the only thing going on, but I think, you know, with Bo Xilai, with Chen Guangcheng, with all kinds of shit hitting the fan every day in China, this is a rather pleasant distraction for the masses, and it's working very well.
So, I mean, is this the dominant then voice on Weibo? Jeremy, you and I were talking earlier. You were saying that some ordinarily very reasonable, even liberal folks that you follow on Weibo were sort of letting the dragon out.
Very jingoistic. I mean, the kind of people that usually comment on my own like Weibo stream are usually, you know, bitching about the government. But when I retweeted something about this dispute, the answers were mostly, yeah, let's go, let's make war, let's go, let's kill some Filipinos. Basically,
war for
very
oil.
Jingoistic.
War for oil.
Yeah. It's,
what are the dangers in this, though? I mean, for Beijing. Beijing in the past has usually allowed things to go only so far. Let's take, you know, another disputed island or bunch of islands, the Diaoyudao or Senkaku.
Right.
In 2005, for example, they only let things go so far. They've stopped most of the sort of Mingjian flotillas from going out there. They understand that there's a lot at stake if they allow this to go too far. And, you know, they also know that, you know, that tiger once you're on its back is a hard one to...
Well, more important, would there be demonstrations here on soil, like, in, you know, in the real world as opposed to on Weibo?
Right.
And I don't think we're there yet.
Well, Gadi, what's our friend Ambassador Huntsman's got a saying that you like to repeat.
Oh, yes, of course. As Ambassador Huntsman said, his favorite Chinese phrase, and as far as I can remember, the only Chinese phrase he would recite in front of reporters is 中国也有政治. China also has politics.
Which means
which
what?
He's referring to the populist sentiments
that
simmer on the internet and that China has to cater to, as Chinese leaders have to cater to.
Okay. And so this is his...
We've heard it from him dozens of times.
Right.
This is him channeling Tip O'Neill in Chinese then?
Yeah.
Okay, I understand.
Pretty much.
Politics is local. Okay, since none of us have really... I think let's wait until we've got like somebody smart like Stephanie Klein-Albrandt to actually talk about what's going on there. This is going to be something we'll be watching. So let's just move to the meat of the matter today, which, of course, is I think something we're all familiar with. But I think everybody knows the inspiring story of this blind, self-taught lawyer, Chen Guangcheng, his work on behalf of victims of forced sterilization, coerced abortion, his imprisonment in Shandong, his house arrest in Linyi, and his continued physical and psychological mistreatment after his release. And, of course, the story about how he lulled his guards into complacency by feigning illness, climbed a wall, broke his foot, stumbled, fell down, 200 times?
Right.
Over a course of 20 kilometers, which I think works out to, I don't know, like once every 20 meters, which is not so great.
What are you implying?
He's blind, though. I mean, the other funny
thing. He's a blind man with a broken foot.
I have an issue here. I mean, everyone kept saying, you know, in the dark. In the dark. Does in the dark matter if you're blind already?
I always said it doesn't matter to him.
Right. Okay, so that's an unnecessary detail. I didn't see that Ai Weiwei had actually said something. I thought I was the first to point that out, but clearly not. Anyway, so then he was picked up by this...
Aishen is ahead of you. I'm sorry.
Of course. So he was picked up by Nanjing-based teacher-cum-activist He Peirong.
Right.
Pearl Her.
Right. Pearl Her.
Right. Twitter handle.
Right.
And how she pronounces...
That's actually how she pronounces
He. It's Her.
So he was eventually handed off to U.S. embassy officials who brought him into the embassy compound in Beijing, where he remained for, six days?
Six days.
Right. So from there, it got very complicated very fast. We will go into it in some detail, but we know that, you know, negotiations took place. We had on the American side Assistant Secretary of State Kurt Campbell representing the U.S. and Harold Ko, who is State Department's legal advisor. And on the Chinese side, it was Cui Tiankai, right?
Yes.
from the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. So what do we know now, or at least think we know, about what transpired during the negotiations? What kind of direction was each side getting from up top? And, you know, was Hillary Clinton involved? Ed, you guys did that terrific – well, no, not you. I'm sorry. You guys.
The New York Times.
And I know that you guys are going to push back on me here, but I thought it was a pretty good piece. And I don't want to put you in uncomfortable.
We're talking about what's called a TikTok.
Right, the TikTok.
Classic form of Washington journalism.
Okay, all right.
Which is where one side has, that we're done with a news event. One side wants to make sure it gets its kind of version of history out. They call up the New York Times, because that's who you call up in Washington, maybe the Washington Post. And you call up your pliable correspondent.
Someone called up the foreign policy. One of the leaks was to foreign policy.
Right.
And then you
present them the exclusive fly on the wall.
Right.
So, minute by minute.
Right. We're talking
account,
about
dramatic account.
Stephen Lee Myers and Mark Landler.
Of exactly what happened.
Twists of diplomacy.
without any prejudice whatsoever.
So clearly, being the journalistic tyro that I am, I didn't know that I was being completely spun here, huh?
I mean, it's very useful to have these accounts, but they should be couched as very one-sided.
You're a cynical bastard, aren't you?
Not cynical. I think quite clear-eyed on this one.
Okay, so let's hear the clear-eyed take then. What happened in those 4 days in Peking?
Well,
I think Gotti was here watching it closely. I was watching it from afar in Chongqing, so let's hear Gotti's take.
I mean, what we saw from here in Beijing was only, what emerged, in public events.
Yeah,
but in terms of that TikTok, I'm sure that you can offer us your newspaper's view of what happened from the U.S. side.
I mean, there's a complicated series of events. I mean, there were negotiations. The short answer is that it seems like Chen Guangcheng didn't want to leave the country. He was asked whether he wanted to seek asylum in the U.S. He said no. So then the U.S. diplomats tried to negotiate with Chinese officials at the foreign ministry.
On that basis
to try and work out some sort of compromise where he would stay in China, study law. They say that there were a host of six or seven cities that they looked at first.
Pared it down, eventually landed on Tianjin.
Right, yeah. Tianjin. And then it was agreed upon that he would go to Tianjin, study law, his family would move there also, and that there would be some assurance of, safety for him. And then later he left... And then it seems like there was a turning point in that he was in the embassy. The Chinese officials wanted him to get out of the embassy. The American officials might also have wanted him to get out of the embassy in time for the SNED meetings. And Chinese officials brought his wife and children up to Beijing. They said that if you don't leave the embassy, we're sending them back to Shandong where guards were persecuting them. And so after some talks with the Americans, Chen Guangcheng decided to leave the embassy and go to a hospital here in Beijing to meet his family. And then from there, it got even more complicated.
Well, so that was on Wednesday, right? So with a deal seemingly in hand, he leaves in the company of Ambassador Lockley. We have pictures. We got the hugs.
Reunited with his family.
Right. And he gives the Post a call, right? He gets in a car, and in that picture I go to see.
Right, and Gotti knows why he called the Post.
He was trying to call Phil, right?
Right, so Phil Pan of the Washington Post did the first big stories on Chen Guangcheng's advocacy on behalf of these women who had forced abortions and sterilizations.
That was in 2005.
He did the first story in 2005.
Right.
And it's in his book, by the way. Quick
and it's in his book, Out of Mao's Shadow. And also he covered his sort of later persecution, which continued into 2006 until he was jailed.
Mm-hmm.
And he was only released from jail in 2010. Upon which his illegal house detention continued. And Phil had covered that in in 05 and 06. And so the one call Chen Guangcheng wanted to make to the media when he left the embassy was to call the Washington Post. And, of course, Phil Pan wasn't on the other end of that call because he's not working for the Post anymore. But Keith Richburg took the call.
Right. And so Keith actually broke it then that he had left the embassy and was on his way to Chiang Hospital.
That's right.
Right. And so he went headed over to Chiang Hospital. And then what happened?
And then he was reunited with his family. And then there a lot of things became a little bit unclear and murky in the hours after that.
Yeah, I mean, that was interesting. So what happened to change the mood from kind of congratulatory optimism to this doom and gloom by about 10 p.m. that night?
One key interaction that he had was with Tung Biao, which actually began, I believe, in the car.
Let's say who Tung Biao. Tung Biao is another lawyer.
Yeah, rights defense lawyer.
Very liberal lawyer.
And Tung Biao basically was concerned that Chen not stay in China, basically that he not trust the Chinese. And that it's a mistake for him to stay.
Trust the Chinese government.
Not trust the Chinese government.
Tung Biao was detained and beaten and tortured during a security crackdown.
Right, right. And Tung Biao was not alone in this fear amongst activists.
Right. But he was Hu Jia's wife as well.
Zhang Jinyan, who also expressed this concern, and she's the one who first tweeted to the world that there were problems here. Basically, she had this. She had made a few tweets in Chinese. Then there was this all caps one in English that was like, you know, what the media has reported about Chen is not true. He wants to leave. There's something like that along those lines. Now, Tung Biao's conversation with Chen has been posted. The transcript
translated and posted. Right.
Yeah, and it's pretty dramatic. I mean, it's pretty clear that his comments to Chen got him riled up. Right. As well.
I mean, the guy is in a very emotionally fragile state.
So you can imagine a guy who's – and also there's the whole recreated conditions of being surrounded by Chinese guards.
Right.
He's a free man in a hospital room, but he's surrounded by Chinese security.
Right, which is exactly what – the same conditions he faced in his house.
That's pretty traumatic, I would think. And then there's, one more important overlay, which is I think his decisions that he had been making all along were first and foremost about his family, and that was what made sense about him leaving the embassy in the first place. I mean, the most important thing that was communicated to him while he was in the embassy was that his family was going to be returned to Shandong if he didn't leave. Which was an implicit threat.
Right. Wow.
Now he's with his family, and now he might see the opportunity to take them all with him to go.
Right. And
Hillary Clinton's in town.
Him to do that.
And Hillary Clinton's in town.
That's right.
Right.
So I would say that those factors were probably, I would say dispositive, as they say.
He also told journalists that his conversations with his wife in that room made a big difference in that she told him in detail how she had been held captive.
Tied to a chair.
Right, tied to a chair, put under mental duress while he in the days since his escape.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so even after he thought about it for 24 hours and calmed down.
This takes us to about what time on Wednesday night?
Through the night. But by the way,
he was up very late.
At this point now, it's not like the Chinese government was preventing him from getting phone calls.
Right. Yeah.
Almost every media organization, that includes The Economist, includes The New York Times, TV, over the phone, and the Associated Press, which actually got the first big interview.
That's right.
Alex Olson of AP got through to him, I think, before midnight.
Around that time. And it was a 20-minute conversation.
And broke the story confirming that he wants to leave. And that was pretty huge. And we all ended up talking to him through the night. He was taking calls, I know, as late as 3 in the morning.
Right. And one critical factor in this was that people have written about since it's the role of Twitter, because it was the reason why every journalist was trying to call him was because Zhang Jinyan had tweeted, had just spoke, as soon as she got off the phone with him around 9-something p.m., she tweeted that everything the media was reporting was wrong.
Right,
in all caps. And she said that he actually wants to leave the country. He fears for his life. And so everyone started trying to call him at the hospital.
Right, this is the first kind of case of, I would say, of a major diplomatic sort of a negotiation.
Scuttled by Twitter. Right.
Scuttled by
Certainly Twitter aided in it, you know.
It was covered in real time. Hyperventilating. I mean, just everyone was just, you know, thrashing about in indignation and trying to outdo everyone else, basically, and saying, you know.
But it was, I would say.
No, seriously, I felt like everyone was rushing to.
Yeah, I know, we've discussed this on Twitter as well, and I think the hyperventilation was partly the form, was the medium. There's plenty of individual journalists who were very responsibly tweeting out developments as they knew them. And there was definitely plenty of commentary that was layered onto that by people who are not journalists.
Were going to retweet like Zhang Jinyan's post, and that's like, I feel like that's a very legitimate thing to retweet because it's making the news. So what else are you, I mean, if you're
the Twitter is, you know, an echo chamber that is a hyperventilation chamber for news. I mean, ever, any sort of breaking news thing is going to look like hyperventilation on Twitter. Have you ever seen Twitter during a sporting event? Yeah. That's what it is.
But, I mean, that's what it was. It was a lot of, well, I mean, it wasn't Monday morning quarterbacking, but it was like post-play quarterbacking where everyone was suddenly rushing.
It wasn't even post-play quarterbacking. It was during, it was like during the game, the people, you know, the quarterback is throwing a pass that's intercepted, and everybody is now deciding whether it was a bad pass or whatever.
I mean, your complaint, Kaiser, is that everyone's rushing to judge the U.S. officials before they had a chance to speak to them or figure out what happened.
Or to let it play out a little bit. I mean, my God, it was...
But what do you mean? I don't understand what you mean by
play out. I clearly believe
that. But you know what the U.S. government needs to be more sort of on the ball about is the fact that Twitter is there. And they needed to be there with their voice.
I agree there.
That would have helped dramatically. The problem is they were a little bit hamstrung by the situation with a lot of other stuff going on, and they weren't ready.
I felt that it was my role then to be that guy to try to...
Well, I mean, I think it's easy to say it's a rush to judgment. There's a lot of people who weren't rushing
to
judge.
But in a way, like, Kaiser, your own tweets were also based on theory and not on fact either, because you didn't know the story either that had taken place at embassy.
No, I didn't. Right? But I mean, I knew.
But I'm saying everyone was tweeting based
on theory.
I think there were a lot of assumptions in the other direction as well, that assuming that everything that America had done was good intentions or with the best of intentions for Chen. I'm not so sure that that's entirely clear. I think
they had
priorities,
other exigencies. I mean, of course, they clearly had to
and they,
get the.
I think, and they clearly made mistakes. If they have a guy with him in the hospital, and regardless of what that TikTok says about how the guy left the room because he wanted them to have some privacy, if they have a guy who's there at the hospital, and they make sure to negotiate that, then maybe a lot of this stuff doesn't happen either. Not the way it developed.
But the frustrating thing for me about this is that, it's not America's job to go around the world rescuing other countries' dissidents. And it's not America's fault that people want to go into your All-American, into your embassies. That's not your fault. It's not your government's fault. So a lot of the hyperventilating on Twitter and, you know, even making its way into some media reports seem to me that, you know, you're kind of really confused about what the important issue
is. I think there are two important issues here that relate to what you just said. One is once the U.S. made the decision to take him in, then they had a responsibility to him, right?
I mean, fair enough.
So that's the major thing on that point. The other is the larger issue that I think we shouldn't miss here is, was Tang Biao right? You know, should Chen feel comfortable about staying in China long term if he wants to still be the man he is, the activist he is.
Sure, but I mean, look.
And I think, in other words, the fact that he's going abroad now to study and, you know, not on an asylum deal, may have ended up in the right place.
Right. Now, I mean, I can fully understand Tung's concern, but, you know, I wish, you know, I mean, in the best of all possible worlds, that he could have sort of stepped back and thought, look, they've cut a deal. They have to. And what I mean by playing out, I mean, is really directed against.
I think it's very, very tough for someone who's seen the very worst of what China can do.
I agree.
To people with good intentions. It's very tough to put yourself in that guy's spot.
Right, and Tung was, if you look at the transcript, partly what Tung was doing was also informing him of what had happened to his friends and his family members, which he wasn't aware of. I mean, he was in an information vacuum in the U.S. Embassy, and Tung was saying, well, I think you should take this stuff into consideration also.
Right. I think he should have maybe thought about the bigger picture, as I said that night, and about
The big picture from your point of view. I mean, I think that's a bit unfair.
I mean, the big picture that is, you know, from a bilateral relationship point of view, a big picture.
But when your wife is being beaten, you don't care about the bilateral relationship.
To say that. I don't think any lawyer... I don't think, nothing about Chen Guangcheng's past indicates that diplomatic relations are anywhere near the top of his priority.
Of course not.
Right. I mean, everything he's worked for is all about the people in his village and the people in the surrounding villages. Right. And he doesn't have any role in diplomatic affairs. The other thing also is, what Jeremy just said about sort of the conditions under which he was treated. I mean, obviously, these have huge psychological impacts on anyone.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the role that Jerome Cohen, Jerry Cohen, emeritus professor of law at NYU, played in this whole thing. Gotti, tell us, who is Jerry Cohen?
Well, Jerry Cohen has been working on rule of law in China issues for decades. He's probably the most respected person in this field.
Absolutely.
And he has advised on writing Chinese laws, and he advised, and he's been an advocate for Chen in particular, for years, and was the person who turned Phil Pan on to him back in 2005. So he has a deep personal kind of stake in Chen's case and in his fate. And Jerry Cohen had this idea, I think, that maybe there could be a way that would work, that Chen would stay here in China, study law, and perhaps have a middle way between...
The Ai Weiwei.
The Ai Weiwei way.
Right. He said he was inspired by the model.
Right, the Ai Weiwei model, which by I would... I mean, we can get to my personal thoughts on that in a second, which would be that he would stay here and he would have some pressure, but he would still have some space to operate. And I don't think I agree with it. The Ai Weiwei model is anything to aspire to at all. But that's sort of was influential, I think, in shaping the deal that emerged when Chen actually left the embassy in the first place.
Okay. And his role was, as you say, pretty instrumental. And I thought his account of what had happened, it didn't strike me as particularly self-serving. I thought that he
not at all. No.
Right. And if you know Jerry, he's rarely a self-serving guy.
No. I think he's extremely
just such a
straight
guy. I mean, everything that he
highly respected, and anybody who's covered anything about to do with rule of law in China knows him.
So let's move along now to where we are today. Now, Chen himself has now said that the government is helping him in the process of applying to study abroad. Where are we at with that?
He says himself, Chen does, that that China has told him that they're going to approve that and get him passports for him, his wife, and his two kids.
And do we have any expectation of a timetable on this?
I think it'll still be some days at least yet.
Right. It's ranged anywhere from days, as reported in the New York Times, to I've heard Jerry Cohen has said
2 to 3 weeks. Yeah.
Right.
Okay. And I wrote something on Facebook that drew down a lot of fire on me. When I was just sort of in an optimistic mood. I'd just been reading to my kids or something. I read that Ai Weiwei's lawsuit over his $2.4 million tax evasion penalty had been accepted by a Beijing court, right on the heels of having read about Chen receiving actual proactive help from Beijing on his departure paperwork. And I thought, hey, are we seeing sort of the first stirrings of a warm wind blowing? A lot of people seem to think so. Others didn't. Where are you guys on this? I know.
I don't feel like we have... feel like we have any data points, or certainly enough data points to lead us to any conclusions. And also, on Ai Weiwei's case is definitely, it's a unique case, a high profile case. There's that saying that I'm now going to get wrong, but about how big cases make bad law or whatever. I mean, I think you can't make any conclusive judgments or insights from a case like Ai Weiwei's just on its own.
A weird outlying.
Yeah, I mean, it involves. The highest levels of politics in China. It's a special case.
Right. And the fact that a court accepted, approved hearing the case doesn't really mean much, because when you talk to him about sort of his time in detention and also about sort of what they questioned him about and the eventual grilling on this tax question, it seemed like that they really wanted to operate in very strict legal limits. Like, they weren't trying to, they threatened him with things like state security, things which could have put him in prison for 10 or 12 years. But in the end, the Beijing authorities decided, perhaps it's pressure from the top, that they had to operate only within the narrow limits of a tax case. And that's what they've been working within.
I would like to plug, going back to Chen on this point, to plug my own story that'll be in The Economist tomorrow, or Friday for you listeners, which is
today for you listeners.
Right. Take a look at the other side of Chen's case, the officials who are responsible for his abuse and for the forced abortions and sterilizations. The official that Chen blames the most is Li Chun, who was the party secretary of Lin Yi from 2002 to 2007. and who was the one who issued an order in 2004 saying that we need to get tougher on population controls.
Where is he now?
He has been promoted three times. He was first promoted to be propaganda chief of Qingdao. Sorry, of Shandong.
Shandong province, right.
Then he was elevated to the standing committee of Shandong province. Mm-hmm. And then he was given a nice party secretaryship of Qingdao in 2010. So his career is doing fine. And what this tells...
To Qingdao, that's quite a climb.
Yeah, it is. And what that tells us is that these cadres are not measured at all by rule of law. They are measured by the internal mandates and targets that the party gives all of their cadres. And they all sign these contracts that they have to achieve certain targets, the most important of which are social stability or political stability. Population controls is often still the case in some places, even though population growth isn't as quite an issue as it was 5 or 6 years ago.
Shandong is the second most highly populated.
Right.
Province.
Economic development, economic growth. Those ones are most important. On some of these cadres' scorecards, these are generally not made public, but some have been seen or some are even posted on local government websites sometimes. Rule of law or acting in accordance with the law might get like 10% of the possible points, you know, whereas something like economic development, one category would be like 40%.
Or social stability.
Right.
And some would argue should be linked to rule of law.
Right.
Obviously, China doesn't see it that way.
But clearly, and also failure to meet the most important targets, these targets come in different categories. And failure to meet the most important targets, which are called like veto targets, you could say, can be met with basically end your career. And can essentially you end up in a backwater or like on the boat, as McNulty was in The Wire. So whereas, you know,
KPIs is what we call them.
The less important targets are more optional.
KPIs. I mean,
it's a bonus.
Key performance
indicators. It's a bonus if you act in accordance with the law, but it's a small bonus.
It's not a key performance indicator.
If you end up violating the law to achieve the higher targets,
that's fine.
That's fine.
And I think if we're talking about data points to look at sort of, you know, what the atmospherics are like or the optics are like right now in China, I mean, I think even just looking at what's happened in the Chun case in the last week, like we look at the people who, his supporters who try to show up at the hospital, like Jiang Tianyong was detained by security and then beaten. They punched him in each ear, obviously trying to deafen him, maybe permanently injure him. And this is with the glare of the international, like, media focused on this case on the single hospital. And yet it seems like the leaders in Beijing can't even rein in the Beijing security forces.
And the main point of my story is that this isn't even about local abuses and the center not being able to rein them in. This is systemically, this is how local officials are incentivized.
Mm-hmm. I look forward to reading
and
the story.
And then I also disagree with the idea that the center can't rein them in because the center can when it has the power. I mean, when it decides to do so, it can easily rein. I mean, obviously, they know what's going on in Linyi. They know what's going on at Chaoyang Hospital in the heart of Beijing. And yet, no one is able to step in there and say, we've got to put a stop to this.
One of the things that caught my attention in the, what we're calling the TikTok by Myers and Landler, was this description of Ministry of Foreign Affairs officials in the hallway arguing with their counterparts in security, these security apparatchiks.
Right.
Has this Chen case opened some fissures, maybe? Does this?
That sounds like a very likely story to me. I mean,
deal?
Well, the unlikely part is, would that kind of argument happen in the open in front of
the U.S. China diplomat? I mean, don't overestimate the ability of the Communist Party to be completely incompetent at times, particularly when dealing with issues like this. The system isn't set up to
be hyper competent enough to manage.
I mean, they let a fucking blind man escape from how many armed guards? I mean, come on. This is the Keystone Cops half of the time. When they don't have their jackboots on, you know, they put the jackboots on the right boot on the left foot, and they mess it up. And I really think it's absolutely believable that Ministry of Foreign Affairs people and security people...
If you put your right jackboot on your left foot, are you a rightist or a leftist?
Well, that's the other thing. To answer Kaiser's original question about this, are we seeing some kind of spring in Beijing, a warming? I don't know if we're seeing a spring, but things are shifting. And, you know, one indicator of that, for example, is our dear friends at jinbusha.org, who hide in America but run this very ranty Maoist website, have now taken to using the exiled writer Yu Jie's language when talking about Wen Jiabao. Plastered all over their website are banners saying Wen Jiabao is the Yingdi, is the greatest actor in China. Yeah. And this is they're
it's
crazy
a
people.
Very
but
funny appropriation.
I think there are things going on at the moment in China, not only with intellectuals, but also within the government, where thinking is shifting. You know, the Chongqing model is now not to be discussed. Things are changing, and we don't know where they're changing. And this being China, they'll probably end in some horrible nightmare.
I don't think the model is dead. But what one of the things that's interesting about that is this. We didn't even discuss this. The Reuters, I guess, is the first to report it this week, kind of like as its lead news item. It's been mentioned, I think, kind of in the context of some other stories, including the New York Times, the possibility that there'll be a delay in the party Congress.
Right. I wanted to maybe hold off on that for next time. But
okay, well, we can tease for next week. Next week, will the party Congress be delayed?
Right. I have problems with the Reuters story and the way they framed it. I mean, everyone I've talked to says the story is framed in a very false way. So,
okay. Well, that'll be intriguing next week.
The big question that I have, though, is so does the eventual deal that was reached with Chen give us a clue about who's really on top right now in Beijing, or is it still way too early?
One of the things I discovered this week that I sent out on Twitter was this magazine piece written by my former boss in Iraq, John Burns, who was a New York Times bureau chief here. And he was kicked out of China in 1986 on charges of espionage after he took a long motorbike ride through the countryside.
Yeah, really enjoyable piece.
And when you look at, there's a critical moment in the piece where he says that he was told that he was kicked out because there was a debate between the foreign ministry and the security apparatus, and security apparatus eventually went out. So when you look at that, then you see that this is a constant tension between the foreign ministry and security officials in China. Like it's, and you hear this over and over that the foreign ministry is the more liberal side, but that they're the more powerless side. And so I don't think it's a new fissure. I don't think it's something new. Like you look at Burns' story from 86, he says that outright, the exact same thing we're seeing reported in the New York Times story today. And you hear it over and over in lots of other situations.
Okay, so let's not talk about opening up of new fissures then, but it certainly sort of shines a light on an existing one then. And,
right.
One that's it's seismically active. It's in play again, right?
I think definitely there's open questions about what next year's leadership lineup will look like and which factions are most strongly represented. So in that sense, right. Yes.
Yeah, if you want to talk about the idea of the security apparatus and whether they're being put under like any sort of pressure right now, then I think you could go look at the reports about Zhou Yongkang and how he supported Bo Xilai, and that he might be under pressure now because he supported Bo Xilai, and that the more liberal elements within the standing committee are trying to use that to knock him down.
Yeah. That's a lot of us are hearing this. Anyway, folks, that was a very interesting discussion, and let's move on now to the segment in our program where we recommend things. And Gadi, what you got for us this week?
Well, I guess I would recommend the John Burns piece we just talked about. Can I do that? Is that cheating?
Absolutely. No. That was really.
I did take the time on deadline, or maybe right after deadline, to read that and really enjoy it. John Burns kicked out in 1986. And what was fascinating, it was just a gripping tale of, you know, he took this kind of trip that today actually we can do, and it kind of tells you a little bit about
how much China's changed.
Things have changed. I mean, it was just a road trip, you know, where he's just talking to regular people. There's no sensitive interviews at all described in there. He got kicked out because, who knows, maybe he accidentally took a
He took a picture of that bridge, right?
It was right. He claims that he doesn't even know what he might have taken a picture of that would have gotten him in trouble. He did admit during interrogations to taking a picture of like a bridge that's a tourist site.
Right.
And then comically, the interrogator says, "So you admit that you were taking pictures of the military installation?"
Secure military installation.
it's a really entertaining read. John Burns is he wrote it beautifully, and I would say that's a nice thing to sit down with on Sunday and, with a cup of coffee.
Great. Ed?
I was reminded for several reasons of a book I read recently. One is that Gadi told me he's reading this new Carroll book on Lyndon Johnson, mm-hmm. and about the transition when he became president. But
you're reading the fourth one now, right?
Yes, the fourth book. It's a
which
great series on
LBJ. I can't recommend it because I haven't started
it. I'd absolutely recommend that. I was going to try and keep it to China recommendations. Right. I did notice that there's two mentions of China in the index.
But my transition.
But I haven't found out what that's about.
My own recommendations. I read this novel a little while ago, which several of you have also read, which is called American Tabloid.
Yeah.
Which is also about the Kennedy assassination. But it's a fictional history of the assassination. And what it, when I read it, I thought, oh, this is sort of it. There's something about this that make that feels like how politics operates in China. And then when the Bo Xilai story broke, and we hear all these other details, like he was really into wiretapping. He had this whole, he and his police chief had this whole wiretapping apparatus where they were trying to spy on other politicians to get dirt on them, and that he was in bed with, allegedly in bed. I mean, I'm not going to make accusations here, but allegedly in bed with organized crime members and things like, and that his whole power structure was centered around, you know, his use of the police force as well as his alliances with billionaires and mafia types. Right? It's all there in James Ellroyd's American Tabloid, which is about how American politics operates.
Which Ed, I know I owe you finishing that book, and I've gotten distracted. I'm reading Wolf Hall.
And I'm going to double up my recommendations then. Robert Carroll, Passage of Power. If you want to see how the Kennedy White House really operated, with I think just amazing portraits of JFK, of Robert F. Kennedy, and of course of Lyndon Johnson, Robert Carroll's Passage of Power.
Okay, take us back to China, Jeremy.
I got two things. One of them is not China. The first one, though, is I'd just like to recommend ChinaDailyShow.com, which I have been following since they started. And when they first started, I kind of was, meh. But the news events and the media coverage of the last few months in China and the Chinese state press's reaction to all these things that have been going on have given them, I think, inspiration. And they're really on a roll. I think some of the best things that have been written about Bo Xilai and Chen Guangcheng have appeared on China Daily Show.
Well, and there's definitely been Art Imitates Life or Life Imitates
Art.
Oh, absolutely. With, you know, like Neil Heywood banging Bo Xilai's wife. Right, or it must have been, right? Says a British, you know, source.
A name source. Like, it's good to look at their art, so-called articles and our, like, the articles in mainstream press, put them side by side.
Yeah, I second that recommendation. I think China Daily Show, I also had the same initial impression. I wasn't sure about it, but they've come into their own on this story.
I think Gotti made an appearance or two. In
yeah, a character
article.
Named
Grady Einstein.
Einstein. The China correspondent, no, the correspondent for the anti-China golfing magazine, Forbes.
Yeah, that's right. They also just did a very good piece on the Twitter conversation about Chen Guangcheng, which is really worth reading if you followed the story or listened to what we just discussed. My other recommendation, aside from spotting an azure-winged magpie on Jinbaojie,
we can't go one aside from that, bird
sorry, but as I got a Kindle, maybe I'm a little late to the party.
You
but,
are.
As somebody who was a holdout for the last print media that I was a holdout of, print books, I'm seduced by the Kindle. The black and white old one that doesn't have any bells and whistles and is just for reading books is fantastic.
Were you a holdout on scrolls, like when Gutenberg's the whole printing press thing came in?
I was like, no printing. The feeling of unscrolling
it's
is
nothing. It's not a scroll of vellum.
It's not a town crier today.
That's right. You know,
it's just not the same as a scroll.
No. Oh, yeah. My turn. I'm going to plug Evan Austin. This is great new piece in The New Yorker, The Love Business, where he writes about Shi Jiayuan, one of the popular dating sites, and about its founder. I had no idea of her story. That was this is the world that we live in here, and it's so nice to read it about it written at such at eye level. I mean, and
he told me about your Jiayuan dating profile. I thought that was
it's deeply touching too. I mean, it's really there's a lot, it doesn't you know, teeter off into the maudlin or anything, but there's something very touching about it. I mean, I felt really kind of moved.
Tough piece to time publication of in the middle of all this China news,
but
it's a good break.
Right.
It's a good break.
Yeah, it was a good break. I mean, I do highly recommend it as you know to get you back into like the fabric of the people who live in this marvelous country. Anyway, Gotti, thanks, man. Thanks for coming by.
Thanks, Kaiser.
Thanks
Ed. And Jeremy, as usual.
Thank you, guys.
Okay, see you guys. We'll see you next week on the Seneca Podcast.